Hello, I'm Kelly Gardner and welcome to Imagining the Past. Imagining the Past is a sneak preview of some of the writers and issues showcased in the 2017 Historical Novel Society Australasia Conference in Melbourne. Starting on the 8th of September, the conference will explore ideas around identity and writing in historical fiction. There'll be interviews, practical workshops, debates, and academic panels. You'll hear from the likes of Kerry Greenwood, Arnold Zabel, Juliet Marillier, and Deborah Challenor, and our podcast guests Kate Forsyth, Lucy Trelaw, Sophie Masson, Solaria Gentile, and Robert Gott. You can find out more or buy tickets online at hnsa.org.au. Today we're doing something a little bit different. I'm here with my colleague from La Trobe University, Catherine Padmore, and we're just going to have a bit of a chat about a form of historical fiction that we both write and that we're both interested in, and that, in fact, we're running a panel on at the conference in September. What we're talking about today is historical biofiction. But first, a little about my guest. Dr. Catherine Padmore teaches literary studies and creative writing at La Trobe University. Her first novel, Sybil's Cave, was shortlisted for the Australian Vogel Award and commended in the region's first book category of the Commonwealth Writers' Prize. Catherine's scholarly work has been widely published, and her short creative works have appeared in Ireland, the Journal of Australian Writers and Writing, The Big Issue, The Australian, and in the anthology Reflecting on Melbourne. She has novels in progress about Amy Dudley and artist Lavina Teerlink. So welcome, Catherine.
Thank you, Kelly.
Do you want to help us kind of explain the idea of historical biofiction? Is there a one definition of the form?
I think it's, well, one of the things that makes it so exciting and so challenging sometimes is I don't think there is one definition. Lots of people over various, at various points have used those terms, biofiction, biographical fiction, speculative biography, belletrist biography, fictional biography, all basically trying to work around how real people and their lives come into fiction. Some people have made it more precise. Recently, Michael Lackey's been offering the definition that biofiction, if we think about biographical fiction, is a novel written about a real person using that person's name, and that person is the main protagonist in a work. So that's one way of thinking about it. Others have slightly different or varied definitions where it might just be about enough to be about a real person. The question of the name may or may not be the defining feature.
So, because sometimes people write books about a family member, for example, I'm thinking of Kate Grenville's The Secret River, where she based it on the life of one of her ancestors, but she didn't use his name. So we're wondering, those are the sorts of discussions that we'll be having at the conference and beyond. Is it biofiction? Is that what she intended it to be? She did intend, I think, to explore his life, to explore the life of a real person. She wanted to understand that.
Yeah, I agree. And I think each of those approaches perhaps has a different ethical contract to it. What happens if you are using the real name? Is it a different ethical relationship to if you're just using some details but you put it under a different name? And different writers, especially in the beginning and end of their books, in those historical notes or author's notes, will account for these actions in different ways. And I think that tells us a lot about that writer's approach to that aspect. So many of us are working with real people. And for historical biofiction, when it's set a long time in the past, sometimes those sorts of ethical considerations might seem less pressing than if we were writing about our grandparents or our parents. But there's still questions that we need to sort out. And I can't say that there's one line to that. I like the way, well, I like to be able to include a very broad range of works under such an umbrella. I think it's useful to us to see what people do with that sort of idea. There are so many ways to do it. I don't want to reduce it down to one thing.
So you can't defame the dead, can you?
Apparently not, in a legal sense.
In a legal sense, but you can get into a bit of trouble with their families. So there are those decisions that people have to make or that we all have to make when we're writing about people from the past who might be, who were real or might be seen to be based on real people.
That's right, yes. And as you say, if we're dealing with those from the recent past or who are recently not with us, then you have got the emotional consequences of family members who might be still existing and who have a very real investment in how their relative is portrayed by other people. People from the distant past, you may not feel it's so pressing. However, there are many people for whom figures from the distant past are very, very real and very emotionally invested in a certain figure from history. And by choosing to portray a king in a certain way that might be a negative light or a different light, you can still find, I think, that you get a reaction to that. It might be unexpected. So,
but I suppose a lot of people write revisionist versions of people's lives, don't they, of people in the distant past. So you might decide that somebody has been badly done by previous biographers or novelists and decide to reinvent that life in fiction through your own perspective. Mary Queen of Scots, say, or Anne Boleyn, or the way Hilary Mantel did with Wolf Hall, just looking at a whole cast of characters through the eyes of Cromwell, reinventing him in a way, but reinventing the others too. So even though you are writing about somebody who has been dead for many, many years, sometimes decades or centuries, the reader may have a different view of that person or a big investment in, no, she wasn't guilty, or whatever it might be.
Exactly, and I think it's part of the interest in these sorts of works is how popular they are, whether that be because people have an investment in them or we're nosy about the lives of those real people from the past and we just want to stick our nose in and find out more about or have that sense of how their life might have been, even if we don't actually have that much archival material to give a sense of that life. For Jerome de Groot, he says that these historical fictions in general are read at the nexus of pedagogy and entertainment. And I think how biofiction sits in relation to historical fiction is an area of debate at the moment. You know what I mean? There's no clear way of saying this is one and this is the other. But thinking about what it means to people to read them, why are so many books about real people from the past being written? Why are so many of them winning prizes? What's our hunger for that? Why are we so interested? It's one of the questions for me anyway, I'm quite fascinated in.
So just that line from Jerome de Groot was about we're reading because we want to learn, but we also want to be entertained.
Mm.
And so that means that if we read a novel based on somebody's life, then we're going to decide, well, we could decide that life that we've read, that fictionalised life that we've read is somehow definitive, that person really did do those things or feel those things or have those conversations. But of course the historical novelist doesn't necessarily always know what happened word for word in those conversations or anything that happened in that conversation. A lot of it is invented. So how does that work then? This is one of the questions that we want to explore a little bit. How much is fiction? How much is historical? It's true for all fiction, of course, but particularly when you're talking about real people.
I agree, and it's been in historical fiction in general, and often more particularly when you're dealing with real people, that question of where the line between the fact and the fiction is drawn is quite unsettling sometimes. We read it at that nexus of entertainment and pedagogy, but because we're not sure sometimes, it can for some readers be quite confronting and if it is taken as the definitive life and someone will say, no, this archival material says this is not the case, many writers are very frank about the places where they depart from historical records, and they're doing it for very particular reasons. And in biofiction, it's often the story needed to be this, so therefore I had to choose to separate myself from X or Y source. And that seems to be very common practice.
So you would say that in your author's note?
Many people do. Some choose not to. It's fascinating, actually. I'm quite nosy. Sometimes when I'm reading these works, I dive straight into the author's note, which is probably not what one should do. We should just let the story speak for itself. But I am very interested often to know the position from which the writer is coming. We have our positions about how we treat, the record versus where we make it fiction. how we treat gaps, what we do when we don't know, how we try to get into someone else's head. But I'm always interested to know what other writers do, and that's one of the things I'm looking forward to about the panel, is to hear from these other writers and think about how they've approached such things and where they've chosen to move one way, or where they've chosen. Often you find you get competing stories about the same person when you're looking at archives that might be someone's recollection, you know, two generations hence, about X or Y historical figure, and that's the closest you can get sometimes. These might differ, and writers have to pick one over the other. And usually you're picking because the one you've picked fits the aesthetic impulse of your story, or the affective or emotional impulse of your story. So, and that will then have a consequence in the way that that person is portrayed.
Because you often hear writers, don't you, saying they look for the gap where the imagination can sort of thrive. But that's also where the dangers might lie, or where you have to make those ethical decisions about what you do with those gaps. What do you fill those gaps with? How much can you imagine, and what is credible, I suppose? And people are often talking about having to make decisions about not what is known, but what could have happened, what is most credible. And when you're writing about somebody that is a real life, sometimes you just will never know that. But the reader may assume that that is true from then on.
From then on, and I think that's the worry for those people who are concerned about what the readerly contract is, what we expect as readers from these works, whether we fess up to our changes as writers in the author's note or not. But yeah, the impact, I think, the thing that that's talking to is the real world impact of such works, that they do get taken into the reader incorporates that into his or her frame of reference, and if that's the only experience of some person's life that they have, that then becomes the defining record, and I think therein lies the worry.
So we think about people who are famous, writing about famous people, and think about all the different interpretations of Queen Elizabeth I or Anne Boleyn or Ned Kelly, or people who are very well known to us. But it doesn't, biofiction doesn't just have to be about famous people, does it?
No, of course not. And I think there's a great movement within that of finding people who might be in the margins, or who exist as a single name here, or are mentioned in passing in the interactions of those great people. And my own interest often lies in the people who are slightly less famous, slightly less important, or part of the same world, but they're not given the same regard, either at the time or historically, who have fallen away in the decades or centuries between. And I feel sometimes there's a sort of sense that you're reclaiming those people. They can't speak for themselves anymore. And by presenting a sort of possibility of how their life might have been, which you hope is, you know, as close to some sort of real sense of the person. Of course, you can never get there. But by doing that, there is a sort of ethical obligation to let those people have a space in the historical record and have a voice.
So sometimes people would... they'll choose, say it's a famous person they're writing about, but they'll choose a Queen's lady-in-waiting to be the voice of that person. They might be a real biographical fiction about the lady-in-waiting, but also about the Queen. And so you get the different view, not just of the narrator, say, but also of the famous figure who's been interpreted many times.
That's right. I think those figures, especially working figures, you know, have a different perspective. Some people are hesitant to work with the very famous ones, because there's a feeling that by a number of authors mention it, that I don't think I could ever really get inside that person's head, so I won't try, but rather I'll give a different view on that person by entering it through the lens of another person who perhaps might feel slightly easier to inhabit for those moments. So, but I think they're very functional. I'm quite interested in characters who, by nature of their work, are allowed access to certain figures, you know, painters, artists, musicians. They're quite mobile in the court situation in the Elizabethan period, for example, and allow information to be passed on that might not otherwise. So the reader gets privileged access almost by the way that these characters can sneak across different social areas.
And I'm also thinking about people like, Hannah Kent's burial rites, which I think she describes as speculative biography, not trying to make great claims about knowing what went on in And how could you really do anything but imagine what goes on in the mind of someone who is about to be executed? But bringing to life a character who's very famous in Iceland but not known outside, and so you've got both of those tensions going on. You've got somebody who is unknown in the rest of the world bringing that story to light, but who a lot of people in that place have a huge investment in. Everybody knows that story. And so she has to make, I guess, different decisions about what to do with the knowledge, the local knowledge of the character.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think those are very complicated negotiations and fascinating creative negotiations and ethical negotiations. The feeling of obligation, what that character, that historical figure deserves. In this case, it's a sense that perhaps those stories deserve to be told in a larger format than one place. But at the same time, you need to be respecting the way that they're told locally to make sure that you're doing justice in that space, if that's your desire, if your desire isn't to overturn or to change, but to draw attention to something that perhaps feels like it still hasn't, it's unfinished business, it still needs talking about, even though it happened, that many years before. I think those sorts of characters are fascinating, and writers seem to be drawn to them. There's, I think, as many of those marginal or slightly unknown figures as there are the bigger figures, if we look at the publishing at the moment.
And one of the ways that tension, I think, comes out in fiction in Australia and New Zealand in particular, it often comes out in stories around early colonial contact and the exploration of one culture of another, or worse, you know, the displacement and misunderstandings between cultures. And, of course, more overt actions like massacres and so on in the Secret River, for example. And it seems to me that there are really a lot of those stories being told. There are a lot of biographical novels or semi-biographical novels being told about those sort of explorations at the moment, those contexts, as if it might be something that we, as you're saying, unfinished business, something that we really need to try and understand better.
I agree. I think for all the attempts we make to create a convincing sense of the past, it's inevitable that part of what we're writing about has to be our own world. It's where we're inhabiting. It's the moment that these things are being written, these works are being written. So I think a lot of the work that writers are doing in this way is to look at those key moments in a country's history where often terrible things happen, it seems to be, thinking about the effects of those events that are not resolved now, and revisiting them to sort of perhaps find a new way to negotiate them in our own present. So whether that be in questions of colonisation or questions of gender, things where something needs to be done, it's still not fixed, and fiction seems to be offering one way of presenting new possibilities.
So I wanted to ask you too about who you're writing about at the moment, who you're working on, and where that research process has taken you.
Well, I've got two people from the past who are preoccupying me at the moment, both of them from the early to middle Elizabethan period. One of them is Amy Dudley, who was the wife of Robert Dudley, the Queen's favourite, whom she met an unfortunate end at a set of stairs. There was great scandal at the time about whether she committed suicide. Or did she? Was she sick? Was she murdered? What happened? And the other one is a female Flemish painter who was employed after the deaths of Henry Tudor's two painters, Holbein and Horenbout. And she served the Tudors from 1545-46 all the way through to 1576 when she died, painting right up to the end. And then Hilliard was working a little bit there, Nicholas Hilliard. What we hear about these days is Nicholas Hilliard and his amazing role of miniature portraits. We don't really hear about this amazing woman who was painting for so many decades between, and that fascinates me. It's one of those partial gaps. We know a little bit, but there's a great sense of what that might have been like for her. So, and ditto for Amy Dudley. I find that she's another one of those marginal figures. When we're talking about Elizabeth, there's great interest in her. There's great interest in a possible romance with Dudley. Poor woman who fell to the bottom of the stairs or however she went there. There's a sense that her story ends there or is a catalyst or block for Dudley, Elizabeth's story. But I'm interested in her herself and what it must have felt like to be that woman in that situation. So that's where I'm working. And what about you? Where are you?
Will there be a definitive answer as to the stairs issue?
Well, there's always the evidence that appears. In 2010, there was the rediscovery of an inquest report that had been missing for quite a number of hundred years. And that was quite fascinating because it didn't solve the mystery. We wondered if it might, but it didn't. But it does open up more questions, I think, around it. So it gives a little bit of more concrete detail, but it doesn't shut it down. So I like to think probably not, but we're endless speculating as we do.
We'll have to wait to read it.
Thank you. And what about you? Tell us your preoccupation.
I'm also a little bit Elizabethan at present, which is not normal for me. I'm working on a book about the Irish pirate queen Grace O'Malley and her meeting with Elizabeth I and then their lives, their sort of parallel lives, which has involved so far a great deal of stomping around soggy paddocks in Ireland, which is fabulous.
Yes, I've done a fair amount of stomping around soggy paddocks in England outside of Oxford, and not so much for the Lavina one, but for the Amy one, I was able to go back and do a lot of stomping and walking around old buildings and reconstructing buildings that have fallen apart. And
so that's important. Walking the ground is important in your research?
I feel like it is. And again, it takes us into that strange place where a contemporary 21st century body is stomping around, not actually in costume, but mentally in costume, as it were, trying to imagine what it's like to be in that place in another time, which is both impossible, but it's the only thing we can do. So you try. But yes, lots of walking, lots of observing. Of course, lots of reading, archival material, trying to get yourself into the headspace of another person and another time. But I find particularly being in place makes a great difference to trying to imagine someone's life.
Mm. You can smell the air, you can hear the birds, you can feel the mud beneath your feet.
Yes, watch out for the sheep. And again, it's coming from our perspective. There's that idea that it can only ever be from our perspective, and we can try and stretch into another headspace, and sometimes we're more or less accurate perhaps, but it feels like one of those obligations. It's ethically, it's important to try your hardest to imagine if that's your intention. Other people have very different intentions. They might be writing from a perspective of a historical figure, but their point is not to enter that headspace but to suit something else entirely. There are a great range of approaches how people handle this. But yeah, for me, I'd like to think, make a space for what it might have been like, even if it's not accurate. If there's no way if we can tell if it was accurate.
So how do you think yourself into that worldview or research your way into that worldview of somebody from the very distant past?
It's a huge challenge, I think. I mean, of course, we read as much as we can. We try and imagine the huge political movements, the religious movements. That's been the hardest thing for me, I think, from our contemporary perspective, to try and imagine a world where the creator is in everything and there's no view outside of that, really. There are different takes on that, but really that's still the defining principle. But as much as possible, I think I've read as many letters and diaries and secondary accounts as well of that space, just to get my head around the politics and the belief systems. And sometimes to try and find corollaries in this world where I don't know exactly what that felt like, but perhaps it's similar to X or Y scenario, and I feel like it's close enough to get me in. Again, we can never be completely authentic. It's impossible because we're writing from the now, but the act, I think, is something that a lot of writers talk about.
Yes, and you were talking before about that readerly contract, the contract between writer and reader. And one of the things it's a sort of invisible thing when we're reading historical fiction is that we know that it's written in the now and we know that there's a level of imagination going on. And we also choose to believe it. So our brains, when we're reading, managed to juggle all those three seemingly opposing ideas at the same time and still enjoy the process of reading. It doesn't drive us mad. It's something that is really, it's quite a specific process.
It's a very peculiar thing. I think it's a factor of all fiction reading. You know, if you're and writing, you're trying to imagine a world. And when you're reading it, you put in that world, whether it's historical fiction or just a different rendering of a place that perhaps you might know or a time that you might know. On the one hand, we know it's an artifact. We know it's constructed. We know it's living mostly in the space somewhere between the pages and our head. But at the same time, you live there.
You believe it.
You believe it. That's right. And it works, I think, when you can manage that balance. That paradox is a very peculiar aspect of reading. And I think it's heightened in historical fiction and heightened further in biographical fiction when we've got actual figures. It's not just general people from a particular time that we've come to believe in, but it's actual people. But still it works.
It works. And so it's very... And that's the joy and the danger, I suppose, that you think, I've read this book and now I really understand Napoleon or somebody who
Ned
was a
Kelly.
Fisherman. Yes, a Wolfie in Port Melbourne, whoever it might be. And yet you also know that what you read was a novel and it might not be true. So in the case of Ned Kelly, you read a Peter Carey version and then you read the Robert Drew version and maybe they say different things and which one is true?
That's right. And also, if you have been someone who's immersed him or herself in the historical sources, what happens then? There's been a lot of talk about when, with historical fiction and biographical fiction, about when readers might know X or Y event from someone's archives or someone's chronicle, and it appears in different ways. And we had this discussion around Kate Grenville's work with The Secret River. It appears in a novel in a different context, serving different purposes from how, you know, one reader might have suggested it was, or one writer. What happens then? You know, suddenly I think often I find if I'm meeting bits of an archive that I'm familiar with, I'm reminded at those moments that I'm reading. They're the things that poke up, whether they're accurate or not. I suddenly remember that I am reading. I'm not inhabiting this world because I know I recognise that from X or Y, and here I am. So it's a curious, it's a very curious, as you say, exciting and dangerous pursuit. At the same time.
And you sort of, you don't want to be pulled out of it. It's like when, you know, I'm sure everybody has this experience of being in the cinema and watching a historical movie that has just some glaring inaccuracy. And it pulls you out of the story. Mm. It pulls you out of the entertainment, the enjoyment of the story.
Because the pedagogical side is not working. You're not learning from it because it's an error at that point. So, yes, I was at a really interesting paper at a conference recently where someone was talking about portrayals of Elizabeth in that way and talking about how once there is that anachronism moment or those errors and you have to work with that. But then once you get past those, what happens if someone is doing that very deliberately? I think there's a lot of discussion with Michael Lackey's work with the biographical novelists about when they are making those choices, are they errors or are they very deliberately done? And if they are deliberately done, what's the point? What's the purpose of that? And I think that's quite fascinating because it can work both ways. If you go with it and say, well, I realise this is a construct, people are playing fast and loose with the facts, as we have done since Walter Scott, and there's a lot of talk about Walter Scott's fast and looseness. If it's done deliberately, why? And, you know, or is it just a mistake? And I think that's, it can pull you out of the text, of course, but it's part of a larger discussion about what writers do and why they do it with their historical record.
Okay. I'm totally throwing Popeye the Sailor Man into my pirate, Elizabethan pirates. Catherine Pedmore, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Kelly Gardner.
Thanks for listening to Imagining the Past. It's a sneak preview of some of the writers and issues showcased in this year's conference of the Historical Novel Society of Australasia. In Melbourne, from the 8th to the 10th of September, the conference will explore ideas around identity and writing in historical fiction. There'll be interviews, practical workshops, debates, and academic panels. You'll hear from the likes of Kerry Greenwood, Arnold Zabel, Kate Forsyth, and Melissa Ashley. And our podcast guests, including Deborah Challenor, Lucy Trelaw, Sophie Masson, Zulara Gentile, and Robert Gott. And me, I'm Kelly Gardner. You can find out more or buy tickets online from hnsa.org.au.